We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning. This is Focus 580, our morning talk program, hour two of the show. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for our program, Harriet Williams and Martha Deal, Jason Croft is at the controls this morning. In this hour of Focus 580, we have a health topic for you. You know, on this program, we periodically have a family practice doctor. He's here every other month, and we do a show that's very general. But then also, from time to time, we have people on the program who deal with particular areas of the body who have certain specialties, and we invite questions on that. One of the things that we know is that back pain seems to be kind of a fact of life. It seems that at some time in their life, almost everybody complains of back pain, and we thought, well, this was a good thing. This was the kind of thing that we, at least one time a year we could talk about on the program. And we're very pleased to have here on the program once again Dr. Jim Harms. He is a board-certified orthopedic spine surgeon at Carl Clinic in Urbana. Works at their Spine Institute. He's been a spine specialist there at Carl for almost 25 years. He also acts as professor in the Department of Surgery at the University of Illinois, and he has for a long time now been good enough to come over here to talk a little bit about the back, about back problems, to try to answer questions, and that's what we're doing here this morning. One thing I do want to say, and we always try to say this when there are physicians on the program, is there are limits as to what we can do here. Because the doctor cannot see you. Of course, we cannot do diagnosis this way. But it's a good way to get some basic information. And if you have specific questions, you can call in and talk about your own situation. And the doctor will do his best. He'll give you the best answer he can. And then, of course, you might want to pursue this with somebody who can see you. But it is a place to start and maybe add a little bit to your health knowledge. And we're happy to help out with that. 333-9455 is the number here in Champaign-Urbana. Toll-free. 800-222-9455. So if it would be a long-distance call, use that. And now you can do email, if you'd like, will-talk@illinois.edu. Thank you very much for being here.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here again.
You suggested, you know, maybe one of the things we could talk a little bit about as a way to start, and we'll see what sort of questions people would have. You said, well, maybe it would be interesting to talk about myths when it comes to back pain. Well, are there some common myths of back pain?
Absolutely. As you know, there's plenty of research about back problems, their causes, and their remedies going on a daily basis. I try to go to the North American Spine Society meeting every year at which physical medicine doctors, anesthesia people, surgeons, physical therapists, neurologists, just everybody involved in one form of back care or another, researchers and basic clinicians such as myself. A couple of papers caught my eye this year at that meeting. One of the papers had to do with lifting. We know that historically it's been thought that if you lift too much, that's bad for your back. There's now a paper that shows that regular lifting may, in fact, have a protective function on the back, and that degenerative disc disease is not accelerated by regular lifting. Now, this is one paper. It was randomized, and it was lots of patients, so the numbers were good. We've always known that exercise is good for the back. And we've always thought there's a window of exercise that's just right for any one individual. Mm-hmm. Do too much and you can overload your spine. Do too little and you get stiff and arthritic and you don't get good disc nutrition and probably your back does age prematurely. So we're now learning that that window is a lot wider than we thought it was.
Now, at the same time, though, I guess I've always had this understanding that it was maybe not so much whether you were lifting or not, but it was how you were doing it, how you were moving, And, you know, I think, for example, this time of year, a lot of people, I'm sure, end up with backaches from shoveling snow, which sometimes involves, and I know this from experience, dangerous combinations of lifting and twisting, which seems to, you know, get me if I'm not real careful about that. Is it still, though, important for people to think about their body mechanics, how exactly it is that they're moving when they are lifting things?
Well, pretty soon you're not going to need me with all this information you're giving out. Let me expand on that a little bit. Yeah. It obviously depends on the underlying physical abilities that you have. So the stronger your muscles are, the more the muscles absorb the load and less the force is transmitted down to a sensitive area. It also depends on how you do things. Mechanically, there are ways that are best to protect your back. Lifting with your knees, everybody knows. Minimize the bending and twisting at the same time, which you've just elaborated. But also we know that people are more likely to get into trouble with intermittent activities or rare activities than they are with daily activities. So if you shovel, if you work in a coal-producing plant and you shovel coal every day, you're not likely to get into trouble from shoveling coal. If you shovel snow once or twice a year, you're more likely to get a backache after that. You can do some warm-up exercises. You can exercise throughout the year with a little bit of similar type activities to minimize the problem. But most of us just shovel the snow, put up with a little backache, complain a bit, and get better in a day or two.
Yeah. Are there cases where, and I guess I'm prompted to ask this question because I was talking with a colleague just about his back complaints, cases where the pain is experienced somewhere else, but ultimately the root cause of the pain actually is in the spine?
For the vast majority of cases, we think that the disc or the joint in the back of the spine called the facet joint, in the absence of pressure on a nerve, is the pain generator. The current theory is if you have a disc aging before its time, you can sometimes get holes in the covering of the disc called the annulus. Chemicals leak out into the spinal canal and into the nerves. If those chemicals go into the small nerves that go to the muscles of the back or that area, you get backache. Sometimes those chemicals can even leak into the larger nerves that come out the back and go down the leg, and that can give leg symptoms even in the absence of pressure on the nerves. It's very similar to when you have a heart attack and your left arm goes numb. There's nothing wrong with your left arm, but the nerve that goes to the heart also goes to the left arm. So you feel it where the nerve goes, not necessarily where the problem exists.
Yeah. Also, in the kind of turning that around, are there issues with things like hips, knees, that where the problem may indeed be there, but that also ends up resulting in pain that's experienced in the back?
Yes, it's quite common for a person to have a knee problem that's felt in the hip, for a hip problem that's felt in the knee. Common may be a little too much, but it is known to happen. You can have hip arthritis that is expressing itself as butt pain, and butt pain usually comes from the lower back, so that can confuse us. Mm-hmm. I have a friend that works at Carl, and he's a hip doctor, and he sends me patients who come to him because they think they have a hip problem when they really have a back problem. It's also possible to have a prostate problem in us men or a female problem in the women that can show up as back pain, not of spinal origin. Mm. You are aware, of course, of back pain if you have a kidney problem, but there are lots of other organs that are near the spine that can have referral patterns to the back. Mm.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Dr. James Harms. He's an orthopedic surgeon at the Carl Spine Institute, part of Carl Clinic in Urbana, and he occasionally is here and has done this for us and with us for a long time. Stop by on the program to talk about the back and about back problems. So if there's a question that you have, I know he'll do his best to give you an answer. 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line, and that one is good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. Also, you can send in your questions by email, will-talk@illinois.edu. One of the things I'm sure that over the time that we've been doing this, often I have said to you, well, just as a way of starting out, to talk about things about a person that would predispose him or her to back trouble, and that they generally seem to fall into two broad categories. And maybe one way you could label them is things that you can do something about and things that you can't do anything about. And maybe that's another way of talking about this. Under the heading of things that you can't change, are there particular things there that would say, well, this would contribute to your back trouble or the possibility that you would have back trouble?
Absolutely. There have been recently published a couple of twin studies that have shown that about 50% of the reason that people have back problems, degenerative back problems, has to do with the genetic material you inherited for your parents. So if your father or mother has back problems, your brother or sister, you're more likely to have it. There's been research in the last couple of years that been looking for some of the genetic markers. Now that the genome is being explored, there are researchers looking for the exact gene that predisposes to back problems. One of the ones that's getting the most attention and seems to be one of the culprits is called IL1A-889T. Now, obviously, I wrote that down. I didn't remember it. But I think that sometimes the cards are stacked against you.
Yeah. Well, is that as for a person or for you as a physician, is that a valuable piece of information? Does that help you knowing that?
It helps me give the patients information so that the patient can do what they can do to avoid future problems. Okay. Now, it's not that whoever it is has to have somebody go through a gene test before they get married because they're worried about what their kids are going to have, but they need to know that the full reason that they have the problem is not that they did something or didn't do something. It has to do with the genes. Hopefully that lessens their guilt and allows them to focus on the things they can actually change. Mm.
Okay. We have several callers here ready to go. And we will start with someone where we are, right here in Urbana. Line number one.
Hi. I'm calling because I had an MRI of my, I guess, spine and hip. And those, I guess it's the pelvis or sacroiliac joint, you know, it's the wings. They said the right side had severe hypertrophy. And I said, what does that mean? And they said, well, it's building bone. And I'm like, whoa. I mean, what does that mean? And they're like, nothing. It just means you're getting older. So, I mean, that's normal to have one side have this thing happening, and it doesn't really mean anything. It wouldn't be a cause of pain or anything.
If you had an MRI, of course, that's where you're put in the middle of a big magnet. Your body absorbs some energy. Eventually, your body gives up that energy. A screen picks it up. A wire takes it to the computer. The computer digests the information. And oftentimes, if we ask the computer nicely, it'll show us some pretty pictures. Somebody was obviously evaluating your pain and, as you say, was looking at your lower back as well as your sacroiliac joint. The bone on the one side of the sacroiliac joint is the sacrum, which is the lower bone in the spine. On the other side of that joint is the iliac bone, which is not part of the spine, but it's part of the pelvis. So the iliac bone, if you put your hand on your side straight to the right or left, you can feel the bony prominence, and that's part of the ilium. That's where us men used to wear our pants before styles changed. That bone can, in some people, be a little bit bigger or a little bit smaller as a natural variation. It just means your clothes are going to fit a little bit different, but it has no effect whatsoever on causing you pain, and there's got to be some other cause. So the information you were given sounds right to me.
Great. Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you. Next caller is in Wellington. This is our line four. Hello.
Yes, I have some questions regarding sciatic. My husband's had this a couple times. And one, what are the causes of it? I heard some mention that they're exploring the idea that perhaps it could be caused by a virus. Two, is there a particular time of the year when it's more prevalent? Because both times he's had it, it's been like in the spring of the year, and I've heard a lot of other people that were complaining of it, talking about it like in transitional seasons. And the third one, what can you do to prevent it?
Wow, that's a whole day conference, I believe, but let me take a crack at it. Sciatica, of course, refers to pain down the back of the thigh. Four different nerve roots come out of the lower back or lumbar spine. They join in the butt to form the sciatic nerve. The sciatic nerve goes down the back of the thigh to just about the knee and then splits into two other nerves. So sciatica refers to the symptom of leg pain from the butt down to the knee. The fact that your husband's had a couple episodes is not unusual, and that means the nerve is irritated for some reason. There may be the nerve could have been stretched, or one of the nerve roots could have been stretched. There could be a disc aging before its time, as I alluded to earlier, and chemicals leaking out into the disc, perhaps when a person suddenly increased or suddenly decreased activities. And by the way, the transitional seasons are when we often can increase or decrease our activities. So that would be the fall and the spring, the raking of the leaves, things like that. Are known to be predisposing factors if you've been sitting around for a while. In general, viruses are not thought to cause sciatica. It is usually a disc aging before its time, a herniated disc, or a spur poking on a nerve. The exception of a virus causing leg pain would be if you get shingles. And of course, that is usually associated with a skin rash as well. I would say you should advise your husband, and maybe you could even do it with him, to get some regular exercise through the winter so that if he increases his activities in the spring, he's a little more prepared for it.
Well, that is not an issue because he does a lot of, in his business, he does a lot of heavy lifting of steel. Sometimes, you know, up to 100, 200 pounds. And he does this every day on a pretty regular basis. So,
well, he's the exception because most of us do a little more sitting around during the winter.
Right. Well, I fall in that category. So there really isn't any other much way of preventing it then?
There are a number of ways of preventing it, or at least minimizing it. He could get what we call a care of the back booklet, which talks about lifting, sitting, sleeping activities in case that could be an aggravating factor. He could visit with physical therapy and do some gentle stretching exercises, maybe on a daily basis. Perhaps his strength is great, but his flexibility might not be as good as it could be. I think that checking in with his primary care doctor, maybe seeing a physical therapist and looking at the way he does things would have a good chance of paying off.
Okay, thank you very much.
All right,
you're welcome.
Thank you. On to another caller. Hidalgo is next, line two. Hello.
Hi.
Yeah.
I've had surgery on my back and bone transplant in my neck and then down on my lower back. And then I had a MRI last year and they showed up a cyst down on my lower back, down at the bottom of my spine, I guess. What kind of a problem does that give you?
Okay. I'm sorry that you got one of those spines that need surgery. And it sounds like you got a neck and a lower back that both are aging more rapidly than usual and needed some help. There are a couple kinds of cysts that are formed in the spine. The most common kind we see, and that's at least in 10% of people, is what's called a nerve cyst, which is a spinal fluid collection, and that just shows up incidentally on MRIs and almost never causes a person a problem. Very, very common, usually in the sacrum, sometimes in the lumbar spine. There's another type of cyst that can be symptomatic. You've heard of a ganglion in the wrist where some of the joint fluid pooches out and forms a hard bump in the back of the wrist. That can happen in the joints of the spine also. So in the front of the spine are the discs and the vertebral bodies. In the middle of the spine is the spinal canal with some bone on either side of it. And in the back of the spine are the lamina and facet joints. Those facet joints have some cartilage that line them, and they have fluid in the joint. If the joint gets arthritic, sometimes it builds up extra fluid, and you can get a cyst that grows out into the muscles. That's no big deal. The muscles don't mind. But if you get a cyst that grows into the spinal canal, that can take up some of the room that the nerves need. That can rub on the nerve and cause leg pain with activity, usually with walking. So I think it would be wise for you to ask whoever told you you have a cyst what kind you have. If it's a facet joint cyst and it's growing into the spinal canal, you're likely to need treatment in the future. If it's any of the other types of cyst, it probably will have no effect on your life whatsoever.
Well, the one that found that they didn't want to touch it. I mean, they didn't want to operate on it.
That may mean that operation on it wouldn't help you any. So probably it's one of those spinal fluid cysts that happen in people 10-15% of the time normally.
Thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
Thank you for the call. Let me just introduce again our guest for this part of Focus 580, Dr. James Harms. He's an orthopedic spine surgeon at the Carl Spine Institute in Urbana. He's been an active spine specialist at Carl for almost 25 years, also acts as professor in the Department of Surgery at the University of Illinois, and occasionally here's on the show, and we talk about the back and care of the back. And if you have questions, you can call us, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. And email will-talk@illinois.edu. Just let me ask you a quick question, because I have from time to time seen when I've been in some of the home centers around town, people who work there and obviously must do a lot of lifting, wearing a thing that wraps around their midsection. And I guess the idea is that that's intended to provide some kind of spine support. Does that actually help if you're going to be doing something where you're going to be doing a lot of lifting, bending, and so forth?
It helps a few people. You've probably seen the black wraparound Velcro type, yeah, often with shoulder straps that look like suspenders.
Right.
There's actually no proof that in and of itself it makes any difference. However, it does remind the person wearing it that they need to use good body mechanics, and is just a little safety conscious thing, but it doesn't really support the back enough to make much difference.
Right. Well, on to other callers, and we'll go next to line one, and this is someone in Urbana. Hello.
Hello. Mm-hmm. I have a couple of questions. I've had sciatica for maybe 15 years off and on. For a long time, I treated it simply with therapeutic exercises, and that, as long as I was quite careful to continue them meticulously, that was quite satisfactory. More recently, I think about 3 years ago, I had a steroid injection, and it's repeated after about 2 years, and it seems to work pretty well. I continue the exercises, and I'm wondering, that sort of treatment, does it have any downside?
For a person that's had problems off and on for 15 years, it sounds like you've got a disc or discs aging before their time.
Well, it's a herniated disc, and it probably was something I did 50 years ago. But anyway.
So you've got a disc bulge, and that is, yes, often associated with back pain, and it can be episodic, and there can be some leg pain with it as well. The fact that it's been 15 years may mean that you've got some arthritis in the back at this time as well, and the arthritis could be forming an arthritic spur. That means that your disc bulge plus the arthritic spur may be narrowing the space available for your nerve. So if I saw you and you said, Harms, I have leg pain when I walk 3 to 6 blocks. If I sit down, it's a lot better, than I would say, sir, you've got narrowing of the spinal canal or spinal stenosis. And one of your options would be a steroid injection called an epidural steroid injection.
Yes.
By putting a long-acting cortisone-like drug around the nerve that's irritated, that can help for weeks or months. You ask about downsides. The problem is the second injection generally doesn't help as much as the first. The third injection doesn't help as much as the second, etc. Also, most of the injectionists don't like to give more than 3 injections a year because they're worried about the systemic side effects of the steroids. That can be weight gain, nervousness, suppression of your normal cortisone production by the body, and sometimes killing the bone in the hip and occasionally the shoulder to give some bad arthritis there. So it's a wonderful thing to do occasionally. It doesn't affect the long-term outcome of the process that's going on, but it makes you more comfortable while you're waiting for your body to get over the pain, if your body can.
Well, the first time it went for about 2 years, and the second time it's at least 8 months now. And it seems as long as I keep up the exercise, I do quite well, stretching exercises, that sort of thing. I'm wondering, is there anything on the horizon with repairing the herniated disc?
If you have a pure herniated disc, there are a number of options. Most people get better on their own and start getting better within 6 to 12 weeks with a herniated disc. For people who don't get better or having trouble waiting, then going to physical therapy and doing some pain-relieving exercises called McKinsey-based exercises can help. Epidural steroid injection helps at least about 80% of people with this problem.
Mm-hmm.
There are studies being done in animals and soon, if not now, in people to inject growth hormone and other growth factors into the discs to try to make the discs younger. That is being done more for degenerating discs than for herniated discs, but there is a big overlap between the two. There are artificial nucleus replacements. That is, if you've got a disc that's aging before its time, a new pad can be put in where the disc center was, and that's moved into human trials as well. So there are lots of things in the future that may be available to help us.
That's a little like what's being done with knees and some other joints now?
Yes and no. I was talking about just the disc portion and just the center portion.
Mm-hmm.
There are at least three total disc replacements in the lower back that are approved by the FDA. Unfortunately, that's a big surgery where you open up a person from the front, you take out the disc totally, and you put in either a metal-on-metal or a metal-on-polyethylene plastic spacer in the spine. And that is for not a herniated disc, but for a greatly symptomatic degenerated disc.
Sounds like very drastic surgery, a last resort.
It is a big surgery, but the people who go through it are generally quite pleased. Unfortunately, there is no insurance in our area that covers it currently.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, you've answered a lot of questions. For someone like myself who seems to have a couple of years between episodes, persisting with the exercises and occasional relief with the injections would seem reasonable.
Oh, very much so. It seems reasonable, smart, and cost-effective.
I might add, I'm in my early 70s now, so.
Well, happy birthday.
All right. Well, thanks for the call. Let's go on here
thanks
to
you're welcome.
The next caller in line, and this is someone who is listening in Decatur. Line three. Hello.
Yes. I had an accident last summer and wound up with a compressed P11. And I'd like to know what exercises you would recommend to just kind of keep things moving in the right direction. Deep knee bends, setups, things, whatever you'd recommend, I'd be interested to find out.
How traumatic was the accident? Was it a motor vehicle accident?
A tree fell on me.
Oh, that's a big-time accident. Okay.
But I don't have any problem walking around. In fact, but the problem is I did have a lot of swelling and a lot of damage on the muscle side, on my left side, above my hip.
If your T11 vertebral body absorbed enough energy to break, that means the discs nearby, the joints in the back of the spine nearby, could have absorbed a lot of energy also.
Oh, yeah.
So you will be predisposed to premature degeneration of those discs and arthritis probably sooner than you would have gotten it otherwise. Also, when people have compression fractures, sometimes they're bent a little more forward at the fracture site, and that puts their back at a mechanical disadvantage. So I would say that you would be benefited by a couple different things. You've already said that the muscles may have been damaged, so exercise to strengthen the trunk muscles would be very important. Particularly if you have some forward bend, the muscles that hold you upright would need some extra work. People who have arthritis or degenerating discs can suppress the symptoms by regular exercise. So a couple minutes a day on flexibility and 4 to 5 times a week doing something for cardiovascular fitness would be wise. Even walking 2 miles a day would be a wonderful exercise to minimize any symptoms that you might get in the future from this injury.
Thank you.
All right.
You're welcome.
Thank you. And again, to someone who is here on cell phone, want to get them, line number two. Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
I'd like to share an experience, actually. I have had lower back problems, including sciatica, for a number of years and had been to many doctors, had had epidural injections and physical therapy. But my relief came when I began doing yoga seriously, Iyengar yoga. I'm aware that there are a number of studies that show success with lower back pain and yoga. And we're blessed here in CU with having one of the top teachers in the world in Iyengar yoga. So I'm pain-free now. I'm driving from a car right now, which would have caused excruciating pain a few years ago, and I'm symptom-free.
I'm impressed. I think that that goes to show that the right kind of exercise can help most people with back problems. If a person is having trouble with regular exercise, I also recommend yoga or water-based exercises to give a person a jump start. The yoga, of course, is relaxation with stretching and some strengthening, and it's low impact and it's no forceful movements, so most people can tolerate that. I think that's a wonderful story, and I'm glad you called so that we could mention that on the air today.
Sure, and I'd also like to emphasize the strength-building aspect of yoga. A lot of people think about it as relaxation and stretching, but for me, my issue had to do with stability around my sacrum, and there's a large premium in Iyengar yoga, at least, on building strength and stability around joints, including, and also in posture and how I use my body is different now, too.
There's no doubt that posture plays an important role in the symptoms that we get when we have a back problem. As I told other callers, I strongly recommend something to keep the core muscles, the abdominal and back muscles, strong so that those muscles absorb more of the load and less of the force is transmitted
right
down to any sensitive area. So I think you did exactly the right thing. And if more people did exercise, including yoga, I think there'd be less complaints in this world.
Well, thanks for being
All
on
right.
the
Thank you for the call. I want to get an email question here, and this is something that I know is a particular interest of yours. It's a question that has to do with scoliosis, and it comes from someone here I think is on the campus. In any case, the person says that she was diagnosed with scoliosis 20 years ago when she was 12. And she was told that there was nothing that could be done at the time because they said she'd stop growing and there was nothing special that I should do to take care of her back. The curve is in the upper back, about 30 degrees. She says, I'm generally healthy, but I wonder if there's anything I can do to prevent back problems or if there are activities I should avoid.
Yes, scoliosis is a lateral curvature of the spine, and we think there's a genetic predisposition for it. We worry about curves that are over 15 or 20 degrees because those are the ones that are likely to progress. We think that once a person is done growing, if the curve is under 40 degrees, the curve stabilizes and is not very likely to get worse. So if this young lady had a 30-degree curve and she was done growing, then her prognosis would be excellent. The odds of her curve getting worse is very small. It is possible for curves to get worse in late adulthood, 60, 70, 80, or 90, if a person gets arthritis in the spine as well. But that's not something we can prevent. It either happens or doesn't happen. As with all patients with any back problem, I recommend regular exercise to minimize the chance of any symptoms from the back in the future. But I think this patient, if the curve is 30 degrees, has an excellent prognosis, and the odds of her curve progressing are probably one or less than 1%.
All right. Hope that that helps. Email questions are welcome, will-talk@illinois.edu. Otherwise, call us 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Back to the phones. Next up is Urbana, line one. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
I have a comment and a question. Along the lines of exercise and posture, I've had physical therapy through Carl twice, once for my lower back a few years ago and recently for my neck. Both experiences were excellent, and compliance with the exercises was absolutely key for my experience. And the lower back pain I'd had for years was reduced to almost zero through the physical therapy, which is fabulous. Also had some success practicing Alexander technique, which complementary to something like yoga has been really good for me. My question was, I was a surgical technician in the early 1990s and experienced several times when the procedure would start and the doctor would find, the surgeon would find things they weren't expecting. And MRI and whatnot was not what it is today. And I'm just wondering what that's like today, if there are as many surprises as it seems like there used to be. And I'll take the answer off the air. Thanks.
All right.
Well, I'm glad you found exercise that helps, and I'm one of those people that's a firm believer, as you can tell from my answers to the other calls. I thought you were going to say you're a surgical technician, and during the surgeries, particularly the long ones, your back and your neck hurt. So I'm glad to hear that's not the problem. Yes, our technology has improved dramatically during the time that I've been in practice. When I started practice in 1980, we had myelograms and CAT scans were just coming in to be popular. Before that, it was myelogram only. In the late 80s and early 90s, MRIs became available generally, and now, particularly with the software updates, have allowed us to see into the body dramatically, and it's unusual that we find a surprise in the spine. It is more common that there was something that we didn't see on the MRI that was there than something that wasn't on the MRI that we see anatomically when doing surgery. So MRIs are a great surgery planning tool, and I really, really love when you know what you're doing ahead of time, you have a plan, and you seldom have to deviate from that plan anymore.
Yeah. What do you think? Just recently, I think there has been some criticism or some concern raised about the number of MRIs that are done and the fact that there is some radiation involved. I guess two questions. Do you think that too many are done, or do you think that physicians don't think carefully enough? They just say, okay, well, we just need to see what's going on, so go and have the test done.
That's another subject that we could discuss all day. Remember, though, that an MRI is magnetic energy, not radiation.
Okay.
The CAT scan is radiation, and there's been some recent articles about the risk of cancer later in life if you go through a CAT scan. Also, surgeons in the OR who use fluoroscopy, C-arm radiation, there are increased risk of breast cancer even in males who do a lot of procedures in the operating room. So let's separate MRI from radiation because that's important. An MRI causes almost no problems. There are no side effects from it unless you've got ferromagnetic metal in you. Now, us orthopedic surgeons haven't put anything like that in for 60-plus years. An MRI is a wonderful tool, and I'd love to have an MRI on every patient who comes in my office. I'd love to do an MRI on every patient I've done surgery on to check on their progress, but in this day and age of healthcare cost responsibility, we just can't do that. There ought to be an algorithm that every physician has in his or her head with the cost-benefit ratio of doing an MRI. At our institution, for example, most of the MRIs we do have to be pre-certified with an insurance company because there are MRIs being done for headaches, for back pain, where the yield is so low that medically it doesn't make a lot of sense to do the MRI. Now, I love seeing MRIs, but we've got to be fiscally responsible.
Okay. Well, I'm glad I asked the question. I guess what I was doing was confusing those two. I was conflating those two, CAT scan and MRI, and I expect probably a lot of people don't really understand what the difference between all of these various kinds of tests are. So,
CAT scan,
MRI, no radiation from...
Right. MRI, big magnet, no radiation. CAT scan, the usual x-rays that you get with your chest x-ray, your hip x-ray, et cetera, and it's a fairly decent dose.
All right. Other questions here, and we'll go next to Sycamore up in the northern part of the state, line number 4. Hello.
Hello. Mm-hmm. I was involved in an automobile accident about 4 weeks ago where I hit a tree head-on, and walked away from the accident because I was wearing my lap belt and my shoulder belt. The shoulder belt seems to have bruised my chest, and apparently the lap belt has given me lower back pain. And I'm wondering if this is consistent with what you know about such injuries.
Absolutely. It saved your life, or at least saved you from a bad fracture and maybe paralysis. So congratulations for being one of those smart people that puts their belt on when they drive. Obviously, there were forces involved when your car came to a violent and sudden stop. Some of those forces were transmitted into the vehicle and to you. The seat belt restrained you to minimize the damage, but there was still some damage. You may have bruised or contused some of the ligaments or muscles. You could have stretched some of the ligaments around the spine. Mm-hmm. That would cause inflammation and certainly could be responsible for the symptoms that you're experiencing. It would be my suggestion that you stay active, do gentle stretching, gradually increase your activities, and expect that you'll gradually improve over a few weeks' time. If your symptoms get worse, it would be time to see your primary care doctor, maybe get an X-ray, and if things get terrible, then an MRI would be warranted.
Well, they're not getting worse, that's for sure. My chest has improved noticeably over the last 3 weeks. My back has improved a little, but it looks like it's going to be a slower process.
As long as you're going the right direction, I would not panic on this account. I would stay active. Remember, people who sit around get fat, flabby, depressed, and lose all the calcium from their bones.
Mm-hmm.
So you need to be active to the point of discomfort.
All right. That's what I wanted to know. Thank you so much.
Very good.
You're welcome.
We have another cell phone person here. Somebody who's on the road, line number 3. Hello.
Hello?
Yes.
Oh, I have a question about necks. And my family is apparently have pretty good bones. All my sisters, though, have had the carpal tunnel syndrome and then the surgery. I'm in my mid-60s, and the question I have is about necks again. Some of the aunts have had surgery to rectify, I guess, spurs and pain that are up in that area. And I've noticed when it's really quiet and I'm turning my head, sometimes I hear this kind of gravelly, grindy noise that doesn't seem to hinder my turning of the neck. But, I mean, when I'm driving, I can turn around and look back and, you know, doing it, going in backwards situations. But I wondered if the sound is any portent of something that's going on in my neck joints.
I think you can relax. I have that also. Most people over 60 have some of that. If you were to put your hand on your kneecap and bend your knee up and down a bit, move your leg back and forth, you would feel some similar grinding sensation. That's because there's irregularities or arthritis on the back of the kneecap, and as it rubs across the femur bone, it causes these crepitations or gravel-like sensations. The same thing is happening in the joints in the back of the spine called the facet joints. There's some irregularities there, and it merely means that you've got arthritis there. It doesn't mean that you've got spurs, or it doesn't mean that you've got spurs poking on a nerve. Your aunts probably had pain going down the arm because a spur was rubbing on a nerve. And, of course, if you have carpal tunnel syndrome, that's pressure on the nerve at the wrist, you can get pain in the forearm and the hand. Sometimes it's difficult to differentiate between the spurs in the neck and the carpal tunnel, but you don't sound like you have either. You just have a little arthritis in the neck. Keep up your neck exercises to stretch, to turn. If you're worried about neck pain, you could do some exercises to strengthen the neck muscles. But from what you're describing, I don't see anything to worry about.
Well, that is good news. No, I don't have any pain, but I'm just sort of wondering what's coming down the road. Thank you for your response.
You're welcome.
Thank you. About 5 minutes left here in this part of Focus 580. Our guest is Dr. James Harms. He's an orthopedic surgeon at the Carl Spine Institute, and we're talking about back issues. Questions welcome. 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. A couple of Urbana callers next. First is line 1. Hello.
Hello. Mm-hmm. I was in a car accident and had 3 fractured vertebrae, which have now healed. But I also was told that I had compressed discs. And my question is, will those discs uncompress or decompress or whatever the word is? And if not, what kinds of problems, if any, will they cause me down the road? Or are they causing me now?
Well, I'm sorry that you have a motor vehicle incident. It sounds like you survived it, so that's good. I'm sorry that you had your three fractures. For people that have three fractures, I wonder if that person might have osteoporosis or lack of calcium in the bones. It would be wise for you to talk to your primary care doctor, maybe even get a bone density test to minimize the chance of additional fractures. It sounds like you're over 40, is that correct?
Yep.
Well, many of us over 40 have some narrowed discs, and that is called a degenerating disc. Can be called compressed disc, but that's not the result of an accident. That's the result of living on this earth and getting a day older each 24 hours. Most people who have discs that are old don't have any symptoms whatsoever. If you do get symptoms, it would be backache with physical activity, particularly that to which you're not accustomed. If you're worried about the future, regular exercise, particularly something for cardiovascular fitness, such as walking, would be good for you. That tends to keep the discs young and keep the calcium in the bones. So from what you're describing, I'm not particularly worried about you from the disc point of view, but you should check out the osteoporosis and find a way to get some regular exercise.
I certainly have done both of those, and actually I'm still in physical therapy for the back in, or for the break, but just am wondering if the pain that I'm experiencing is related to the discs that were compressed at the sites of the fractures. So.
Well, remember, as I told an earlier caller, if you absorbed enough energy to break a bone, you could have irritated a disc that was aging before its time, or you could have irritated some of the joints in the back of the spine. Time and exercise are best for this.
Okay, great. Thanks very much.
All right, thank you. Another Urbana caller is up next, line two. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Is swimming good for your back and spine?
Absolutely. Patients who have trouble doing land exercises are often sent for aquatic therapy, which is exercise in the water. Many arthritic patients have trouble exercising at all, and we can jumpstart them by having them do water exercises. Swimming is also a good exercise for cardiovascular fitness. Now, I personally don't like the cold water pools, so you're not going to get me to do a lot of swimming, but it's a wonderful exercise.
Okay, well, thank you.
Okay, and line three, this is Urbana. Hello.
Hello.
Mm-hmm.
I have a question. I have a movement disorder, and it puts a lot of stress, obviously, on my neck and upper back. Do I need to be concerned about long-term consequences of that?
Movement disorder generally means that there are spontaneous motions due to the nerves sending out abnormal signals in the muscle.
Mm-hmm.
A movement disorder could be something like Parkinson's. There are a number of them. In general, it is not a big risk factor for spinal problems. So remember I said earlier on the program that there's a window of activity that's good for a spine, and motion helps keep the spine young and minimizes pain. So you may be actually at a little less risk for some conditions of the spine because of your movement disorder. All in all, I don't think it's going to make a whole lot of difference in your life.
Oh, thank you.
All right. Thank you for the call. Is there anything that an individual could do in terms of lifestyle, diet, nutrition, whatever, that would promote disc health? I mean, particularly if they're someone who is prone to degenerative disc problems.
It's thought that mild compressive forces followed by mild distraction forces help the nutrition of the disc, so that walking is thought to be one of the best activities, because when you step down, there's slight compression as you, and then the disc springs up a little bit. So those kind of activities are thought to be best for disc health.
So
nutrition-wise, doesn't seem to make a whole lot of difference unless you're bad enough to have a vitamin deficiency.
So pretty much exercise is the one thing that you can say, and maybe particular kinds of exercise, that's maybe the one thing that you can do.
People that are more than 20% over ideal weight seem to have more back complaints, although that's being brought into question at the present time. But in general, exercise is the single most important thing that one can do.
And I think also, based on our past conversations, that one of the things that is can be a contributing factor to back problems is smoking. So if you smoke, it would do, for more reasons than that, it would be good to quit.
Yes, sir. Cigarettes, there's a high association between cigarette smoking and back problems, and it's thought to poison the enzymes in the disc that keep the water in. I'm simplifying some.
Yeah.
So cigarette cessation is the other thing I recommend the most, besides exercise.
McLean County, one more caller here, at least. Line one. Hello.
Hi. I have two quick questions. I'll ask you the first one, for most important one first, and that is, do you have like a website websites where there might be some suggestions on how to do healthy, safe stretching exercises and strengthening exercises that you could do at home? Because I'd heard that some groups, the national organization was supposed to have, you can use your cans of soup and things like that to do things at home.
Yes.
If you have any ideas on that, I'd appreciate that.
Carl Spine Institute has a website. Google it. And there's also a self-care back booklet. And if you were to call the Carl Spine Institute at 217-383-6555 and ask that one of those be mailed to you, we'd be happy to do so.
Okay. All right. The second question is, and if you mention it, I'm sorry, I just turned the radio on about 10 minutes ago. Did you talk about vitamin D at all in terms of what do you recommend taking or how much is too much?
We did not talk about that. Vitamin D does not have anything to do with the disc health, but it does have to do with preventing osteoporosis.
Mm-hmm.
And calcium, vitamin D, and weight-bearing exercises are what's necessary to keep the calcium in the bone. If you're not doing well, then bone hormones are necessary in addition. It would be best to talk to your primary care doctor about the exact dose that you would need. That's an evolving technology, and the recommendations are for much higher doses than we recommended 10 years ago.
Right, yeah.
So I can't give you the exact number of units for you because I don't know your situation in terms of your weight, your body shape, your age, etc. And that's a good thing to discuss with your primary care doctor.
There, we'll have to stop. I have to jump in here. My apologies to the caller, but we're just at the end of the time. We want to say thanks very much to our guest, Dr. James Harms. He's an orthopedic surgeon at the Carl Spine Institute. Thanks very much for being here.
It's a pleasure to
appreciate
be here,
it.
And I hope to be your longest-running guest. Remember, I started in May of 1982.
I think you're right up there with some of our longest-running guests, and we appreciate you giving us the time. Thanks.
You're welcome.
Much.